Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ah, it is really nice to hear that music again. Hi guys, this is Zach Twomley from When Diplomacy Fails podcast, and here we are with a talk episode that I don't really know what to call. It's great to be back in this limited form, and it's great to finally be doing a talk episode with Sean, because it's been absolutely ages. So how are we all doing? I hope we're doing good, because I'm really looking forward to presenting this to you guys. I know it's been about a week since I finished the July Crisis project, so this should tie in nicely with all that. I don't really know what to call it, because it was kind of, I'm not going to say spur of the moment, but I mean, it wasn't planned as part of the July Crisis project to put a talk episode in at the end, so I kind of just stuck it in there in the feed as like a talk episode all into itself, because we don't just talk about the July Crisis, although we mostly do. Anyway, so I hope you guys enjoy it. There's a few interesting things in there, one of which is the competition that was Sean's idea to launch, in which you could win a copy of the game Verdun, which is a first-person shooter set during World War I. And to find out details about how you could be in with a chance of winning a copy of that game, stick around at the end and we'll explain to you the terms. It's all very simple. I also finally get around to thanking all the people who have donated to the podcast during the July Crisis project, mainly because I was just completely overwhelmed by the generosity of people. I was really surprised. It's unbelievably nice to have that email that says, you have a pending donation, and then to open it and be like, oh god, this person's sending me all this money just because I'm doing this. I mean, in retrospect, I'm working, like, I was working flat out for a good while, but even so, I mean, to think that people would send me money because I'm doing my hobby, like, that's crazy. Anyway, thanks very much, and you'll be bombarded with lots of thank yous, but you'll also hopefully enjoy what is a very enjoyable conversation between two friends. I really enjoyed having Sean on the podcast, and I hope you're able to get something extra out of this. We mostly go over what you've already heard, but in some sense, it's nice to hear it again, because it kind of wraps up the whole project in a more kind of informal way, because the whole project has been quite formal, I think, because it's been very precise and I've tried to have very few mistakes and all that kind of stuff, and I tried to do it in a slightly different style, and I've called it my podcast thesis and all that jazz. So this is kind of a nice relaxed way of kind of closing it out, so I hope you do enjoy it. Let me know what you think, and I'll be talking to you guys very, very soon. So thanks and enjoy. The next voices you hear will be mine and of course Sean's. Back on the podcast, and my guest as always is Sean. Say hello, Sean.
Hello, how are you?
Oh, very good, thank you.
Very good, yes.
Very, very good. Excellent, in fact, and very excited to have you on the podcast for the first time in a very long time.
It feels like it's been a year. That's what it feels like.
When was the last time? It was when we did 30 Years War episode.
Did we do the 30
we
Years
did,
War?
We did one 30 Years War episode. The plan was to do two, and then you were in Sweden by the end of the 30 Years War, so we couldn't do a second one.
Yeah.
So we kind of just left it at one.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are,
after
the mammoth July crisis that cannot believe is over.
Well, it had a timer on it, you know, it expired at the end of July, beginning of August.
Yeah, I can't believe I managed to keep up with it. That was a very stressful time. We'll get into that later, but first, in the tradition of this talk style, I think we should start with something that my listeners have not heard in a very, very, very long time.
Be fit!
If you're looking for ways to support, get in contact with, or inquire about this podcast, Be Fit is the best way to do it. Now, Sean, what is Be Fit?
B is for blog, where you blog about stuff. Actually, he's using it. I can testify to this. There are pictures of it and bibliographies.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a donate option there.
Oh, yeah.
So,
which some of you have been using very successfully.
We will thank you in person. No. By name later on in the
yes,
episode.
We will. Yeah. So hang on for that. If you want your claim to fame, then do hang on at the end. So the name of the blog is wdfpodcast.blogspot.ie. So E is for
email,
where you can email me directly, as the name suggests. And mm-hmm. It's always nice to get emails, even if they're just sent from iPhones, and it really doesn't even take that much effort. It's still nice to get them.
Yeah. We can't tell if you send them from an iPhone.
Well, it says at the bottom of the email, sent from my iPhone. Really? I used to think that people were snobby enough, because this was back when people, like, not many people had iPhones.
Yeah.
So I used to think it was like people wrote at the end of their email.
At the end. Oh.
Sent from my iPhone, because I have an iPhone, you don't. But no, it's just
an automatic thing. Card. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But yeah, so the email address is wdfpodcast@hotmail.com. Mm-hmm.
So really simple.
Yeah, just very simple, very straightforward. Yeah,
You can't mess it up.
F is for
Facebook.
Yes, it is.
Facebook, where you can like our page.
Mm-hmm.
When Diplomacy Fails. Mm-hmm. It's got a little picture of a bomb. It's mm-hmm. really cool.
Yeah.
There's also the History Podcasters page, where if you just want to get on and chat away with a couple guys that do podcasts. I mean, I say a couple guys, there are a lot of people on there.
Loads. So many. When I started there was a couple, and now there is just so many I can't even count them. But it's very great. Exciting. Yeah. Very, very exciting.
It's great.
I'd love to be like, so who here makes a podcast? And just see how many people are like, me. That'd be fun. For some other time, perhaps.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so that's the History Podcasts page, and there is the When Diplomacy Fails podcast page as well. So search for both of them, and you will find them, and you will be happy that you found them.
So I is for iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though we were complaining just a minute ago about iPhones coming in being snobby,
yep,
we still use iTunes. So if you want to write a review on there, and subscribe to us so that you can stay up to date with the podcast. That is absolutely fantastic.
That would be great.
That would really support this podcast more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. And you guys have been doing very well. I do keep on looking at mainly the American iTunes store, because that's where most people review. It's kind of sad. I kind of look at there like most of the time. Just to see what you guys think of it.
Yeah, this guy is like, he will check like at least once a week on all of the different stores.
Oh,
just
yeah.
To see if people have written reviews. So yeah. Don't think that it's pointless to write a review. You will be seen.
You'll be seen. You might not know
it,
but I will see you. Oh, another thing as well. I recently looked at the Swedish iTunes store. So all my Swedish listeners, some of whom have been there since the beginning, you know who you are. It's very exciting to see you guys there. So that's nice. Yeah.
Tell a friend.
Yes. Tell a friend.
Tell someone over
tea. Not even tell someone. Now.
It's tell anything.
Tell anything.
Like, just look at your computer and tell it to listen to When Diplomacy
Fails. Are desperate, okay?
Yeah.
It started off as tell a friend, then tell someone, and now it's tell anyone.
Anything.
Now it's tell anything.
Anything. Just inanimate objects, just get in there, tell them to listen to this podcast.
The people in white coats might come, but while they're taking you away, that's the time to tell them about the podcast. So that is Be Fit. If you've done Be Fit, or if you're thinking of doing parts of it or all of it, thank you so much, because it makes such a big difference to have your guys' support. I've really noticed the support over the past few weeks, especially when I've been like in the depths of stress with the July Crisis project. So.
And like, I didn't help at all, because I was like, let's hang out. And he's like, I got stuff to do. I'm like, let's hang out now.
So thank you so much. And thank you also to the people who may not have been doing Be Fit, but who are part of my life and who I've been ignoring for the past month and a half. Mainly Sean, but also my family members.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, guys.
Yeah, I really like how you presented the entire thing. It was really like narrative driven.
Oh, thank you.
All the historical facts were there, at least that I know of, because now you've told me them.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the way you told the story of the assassination of
Franz Ferdinand.
Franz Ferdinand, yeah. That was, the way you told that story was just fantastic.
Oh, and thank you.
It was a great way to kick off the series.
Yeah, I think that was the prologue episode. It was very important I got that right because it set the tone for the rest of the episodes.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was listening to, because I didn't want to listen to them as they were released because I thought that might, I don't know, distract me or whatever. But I'm kind of weird like that with podcasts, any kind of podcast specials.
Mm.
I like to listen to them all in one go, kind of when they're released. So I kind of started listening to them once I'd finished. But then I realized that my brain was just so sick of the era that I had to wait for a little while before I get back to it. So in a few months' time, I'll probably listen to it all the way through.
Yeah, and like, your editing was great, and there were only twice do I remember hearing you say the same word.
Yeah, I remember myself, I did that as well, yeah. I was.
You just said and then and again or something really basic like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Or just repeating a sentence. But I think I only noticed that twice. Mm. Out of all of those episodes, it's fantastic.
Oh, cool. Thank you. Well, that's great. It's good to hear that because, jeepers, when, especially in some of the later episodes, I think, I'd say from like the end of July, so like the 28th to about the 31st, I was literally, even like from the 28th of July to like the 4th or 5th of August,
It was literally every day I was getting a notification saying the new episode. I was doing my best to keep up with it, but it was just nonstop.
But the thing was as well, like earlier on in the project, I was doing the legwork beforehand.
Mm.
Like when some of the episodes, like say the ones like Away from Vienna and the one where Nikolai Hartwig dies and the one with the Hoyos mission, they were all done well in advance, like had about a week or so of a gap.
Okay.
But the later ones, I'm doing them on the day that they're released. Yeah. And that was just so immensely stressful. And then once I'd finished that episode, I'd start the one for the next day.
Yeah.
And this is like in between work and everything else, like my part-time job.
Yeah, so
just
this guy really worked his butt off to do it, and it's just the end result is fantastic.
Thank you.
It's a testament to your determination.
It's a testament to my insanity, really.
Yeah.
Can't believe I did it. And like, I still feel kind of tired from it now.
Yeah. And it's been a whole, we're recording this on the 15th. It's been a whole 10 days since the end of it.
Yeah. Wow. It was quite, but I'm so glad I did it because now it's there. It's there in the airwaves in the exact way that I wanted it to be.
Yeah. I think what I really appreciated was while you were telling the story, you were taking the time to go out and fill out the backgrounds for all of the states that were involved. So finding out about Serbia and its history and its recent history and how its underground organizations formed and to that little correlation with how the Italians took over Libya and had that inspired the movements that took off in Serbia. It was interesting to see, especially when you went through all the other nations as well.
Thank you.
You could have told the story without it, but it's just really nice to have that extra filling.
So. The interesting thing about the profile episodes is that if you listen to the introduction, I claim that I'm going to do a profile on every single power that was in it, and I ended up only doing three because by the time I got to Russia, I was just
fairness, the Russian one was the best one.
Oh, really?
Russia, yeah, I think Russia, once I listened to that episode, I thought Russia were the coolest country.
Yeah, you really did.
I was adamant that the Russians were the good guys and that they were just so much cooler than their communist current version.
But I really wanted to get the Serbian one out because it had never really been kind of communicated before.
That needed
and the Austria-Hungary one was important to know so that you knew what Austria was going through. And I think Russia I really wanted to get out as well because it would have been the plan was after doing the Russian profile episode to do one on France and then one on Germany and then one on Britain and then one on the Ottomans and one on Italy, kind of smaller ones.
So that
would have been like 8 profile episodes altogether, which is crazy when you think about it because I spent so much time anyway. Like, I don't know how I thought I was going to have enough time. But that's kind of why I said that I was going to do loads of profile episodes, and the profile episodes, they stopped after Russia. I actually had gotten partway through the French episode. There's like 8 pages done on the French profile episode, but I just couldn't get the time to get it out.
Well, in fairness, I didn't notice because the you actually had to fill out more during the later episodes, so that we'd understand. So especially when you were talking about Britain.
Yeah.
You weren't just talking about Britain. You were having to explain why Britain was in its situation.
Yeah.
At the same time as giving its relation to the current events.
I think when I started, I was afraid that when I did the actual... See, what I didn't want to do was, on each episode that came out on that day, I didn't want to spend a long time talking about background information. Mm. So that's why I figured a profile episode would be useful.
Yeah.
Because it would save me having to do that. And yeah. I could just talk to the listeners as if they know exactly what's going on. But it ended up working okay, even though I wasn't able to release one on every single power. Yeah. So
from this fantastic kickoff and then following through the days as it happened,
yeah,
for the assassination and the fallout from that, that was probably the most enjoyable part for me, because the rest of from there it just became nitty gritty negotiations and miscommunications. From before that, everything was up in the air, everything was really exciting, and you just really captured the whole confusion and momentum of the Austro-Hungarian reaction.
Hmm.
And gauged it really well, so that it really did feel like Russia and Germany and France were just completely oblivious to what was going on in Austria-Hungary.
Yeah, well, they really were. Like, Austria-Hungary is just, like, looking at it, the way, like, I had an idea going into it at the start about what Austria-Hungary was going to be like, because I knew going into it that they had a certain amount of responsibility to share for what happened, but I had no idea how incredibly incompetent they really were.
Yeah.
Like, it's incredible to see the amount of mistakes that their statesmen made, like Berchtold declaring war on the 28th of July before his state is ready at all for war, or before public opinion is ready at all for war,
yeah,
is an obvious one. But even just the fact that it took them so long to respond,
yeah,
like the whole idea of the fait accompli policy that Germany wanted Austria to do, which basically meant wrap this up quickly, guys.
Yeah.
Instead of doing that quickly,
and that's why the blank check was issued.
The blank check was issued to kind of support Austria in the course that it was going to take, which Germany hoped would be a fast response. In other words, like an occupation of Belgrade. Which, like, later on was...
Became the halt in
Belgrade. Yeah, exactly, yeah. But it's just amazing to me that Stefan Tisza, the Hungarian minister-president, could have had such an impact on it. And no one knows his name. You ask people, okay, so the Austrian Archduke was assassinated on the 28th of June, but Austria didn't declare war until the 28th of July. Why not? They'd be like, I don't know. No one knows who Stefan Tisza is.
Yeah, and in fairness, I didn't know until I listened to this podcast.
In fairness, I didn't know until I researched and did this podcast.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Even in the interesting thing as well, what I loved about this July Crisis project was, after investigating it, and I said this in my conclusion, how wrong I was compared to the July Crisis episode I did that was like an hour long that I released as part of the World War One special over a year ago.
Mm.
So completely different. To what I thought happened.
Yeah.
It just goes to show, like, the material that was out back then, a lot of it was the same as it is now, so it was, like, that's not an excuse for me to use.
Yeah.
It was more the case back then because I wasn't investigating it as heavily. I had these preconceived notions of what was going on, so I kind of just went with them more than anything else. Like, I went with Germany.
And in fairness, the reason we have those preconceived ideas is because our textbooks in schools pretty much tell us that's what happened.
Yeah, pretty much. And even nowadays, like, most people in most countries will assume that this is the way the Germany started it. Philosophy is rampant in the historical consensus.
Well, at least in everywhere but Germany, probably.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is what struck me. I think my dad said this because he said he heard it somewhere on the radio, I think, because RTE, the Irish television station, was doing this special on World War One as well.
Radio Televisión.
Yeah, that's what it stands for. and one of the historians on it was saying that we are the first generation who will not attribute blame solely to Germany for the start of the First World War, which I thought was interesting because in a way it suited what I had come to my conclusions in the July Crisis special.
Yeah.
Because it is true, it's not all Germany's fault. It's not even all Austria's fault. Everyone is equally to blame. The two books that I drew on the most, the first of which was Sean MacMeekin's book, July 1914, and the other one was Christopher Clark's book, The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914.
See, I thought, I saw those two books sitting on your shelf. I thought The Sleepwalkers was like a zombie sci-fi book.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was like, why are those two sitting on top of each other?
Yeah, they were very, very important. They were like my Bible for this project. So yeah, okay. I very much drew on them. I drew on other ones as well. There was this other one. There's this other book by Thomas Oate, I think. It's called just July 1914 or something, or the July Crisis or something like that. But it wasn't out until like the 5th or 6th of July of this year, so I couldn't get it in time. Okay. But I might get it still, because in my master's I'll probably be looking at this again. Yeah, but it was just interesting to see how these two books contradict everything I thought I knew about it before. And for a while I was resilient to changing my preconceived notions, but the week or two I had to research the limited amount that I could beforehand, before I actually really got into it, I was able to kind of decide, okay, I can either do this project with the ideas that I already have and try and find a way to back them up and try and present it as though, like, Ozak was right kind of thing, or I can come to this with an open mind and just see what I can learn from this see if there's anything new here. And there really was. Like, I was amazed at how wrong I was.
Yeah.
And how completely different the whole situation was. And how it was Germany really, like, you can almost feel sorry for Germany being pushed into the war.
And I saw a couple comments saying that your German sympathies really do shine through. I mean, we all know you love Bismarck. And we all know that if Bismarck was 50 years later, that war would have easily just gone the other way.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Because the first thing Bismarck would have done would have been like, is this to Germany's benefit? No, so it's not going to happen. And he would have done everything in his power.
Yeah.
He would have been the one. There was a suggestion floating around in the kind of the last days of peace. Well, let's just give our navy to Britain so that it has no cause at all for concern. Tirpitz, of course, was completely against it, being the Grand Admiral of the German naval cabinet. But the German Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg, was very much up for it, but he wasn't able to persuade Kaiser Wilhelm II to go for it either, because Wilhelm, of course, loved his fleet more than he loved this idea. I mean, it would have been hell of a gesture for Germany to make.
And it would have gone, we're not going to attack those French borders, which is the only flimsy reason you have to protect France. Now you have our ships, so we can't even attack it. But I think the real problem with Germany was the strict adhesion to the Schlieffen Plan. I think that was their own undoing.
Yeah, it really was.
If they had reacted to the situation instead of running a plan for a simulation where it was all-out war, they could have been seen as the victim, or at least not as the bad guy, as the aggressor.
Yeah.
The villain, even.
Yeah, but it even comes down to simple facts, like, why didn't Germany just do what Russia was doing? Why didn't Germany just keep on mobilizing in
secret?
Yeah, well, not even in secret, just not declaring it. Like, Russia didn't make, when it did generally mobilize on the 30th of July, when Russia did declare general mobilization, it didn't keep it a secret. But what it did do was, it didn't send a telegram to all the countries of Europe announcing that it was generally mobilizing.
Yeah, it just did. Yeah.
So people had to find out themselves. So what if Germany had just done that and prepared like everyone else? But the reason why it didn't just do that wasn't because Germany was the aggressor, or because it was the belligerent devil country of Europe. It was because because Bethmann Hollweg, the Chancellor, had this bizarre notion of what the legal way to wage war was, and he thought
Germany respected the Dutch too much is what it was. They respected that Hague Treaty.
That
was like, these are the rules of war, you must respect them.
Well, as far as Bethmann Hollweg was concerned, it was the 1907 Hague Convention that said in order to wage war you must declare it. So Bethmann
and mobilization is pretty much waging war.
Yeah, and Germany's just like Russia's period preparatory to war, which we'll get into in a little while, Germany's immediate danger of war, it was going to lead to war no matter what happened. Like that, because it had been set up to facilitate war, basically, just like mobilization was. Like the two things were basically interchangeable. It was just a case of what we called them. The reason why Bethmann Hollweg declared war was because he figured the only way to continue on in Germany's course was to declare war. The only thing that Russia hadn't done was declare war. In every other sense, it was at war.
Yeah.
So, in that sense, Russia declared war first, but of course it didn't, because it didn't sign the all-important document and place
says,
itself.
Hey, we declare war. It'd be interesting to see if Russia had declared war. Would France have felt obliged to also declare war? And would Italy and the Ottomans have had to have stepped in straight away?
Yeah, that's interesting, because the whole thing about the Triple Alliance was that it was supposed to be defensive. So Italy was able to bow out because it said that Germany had declared war.
Yeah, and that's something that I'm sure the Germans really regretted.
Yeah.
Straight away were like, well, that we declared war because they weren't declaring it.
Yeah.
We're doing this out of defense.
Yeah. that is pretty much why it happened. Yeah.
They haven't declared it, but we're just putting it out in the open that they are going to declare war on us.
Yeah. But because they did that, Italy and Romania and other countries in the Balkans, like Bulgaria, who were leaning towards the idea of the Central Powers, they were able to absolve themselves of the conflict for the moment and say, okay, well, the terms of the treaties that we signed with you are now violated because you declared war first.
Yeah.
So, in this way, like, Bethmann's jumping of the gun seems absolutely insane when you think about all the things he sacrificed. Not only did he place himself on the historical guillotine, but he also ruined all the years of diplomacy that
with Britain and everything.
Like, we can definitely fault Bethmann for doing that. Stating that because he declared war first is proof that Germany willed the war and wanted it is another argument entirely.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say Germany wanted that war, and we can definitely see by how the war panned out.
These are the kind of things that are never really stated. They're just kind of accepted. Like, the Schlieffen Plan itself is a plan that exists because Germany is in a weak position.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why else would it have to invade France through Belgium? Like, come on. That's a terrible, terrible plan. It's risky and it's fraught with loads and loads of problems. Not least the fact of, like, offending foreign opinion.
And the fact that Belgium is very defensible.
Yeah, very, very defensible because it's such a small country. It just lines itself with forts. Of course it's a bad plan, but the fact was, this was the only plan that they had.
Yeah.
The other plan that they had, I discovered that there was this plan for a limited war against the Eastern Front, just the East, just Russia. It had been abandoned in 1903. So,
really?
In 1904 was effectively when the Schlieffen Plan began to take shape.
Well, would you say that the Schlieffen Plan would be a proof towards Germans willing of this war? That he couldn't see a war without going to war with both, without declaring it, without going forward by itself. Because if that's true, if their idea of war was always to go in total war, then surely some sort of blame should be assigned to them, more so than everyone else.
Well, yes, that's true, but at the same time, Russia was the exact same, and so was France. No one, because the alliance system was a weird thing. It was like, it was set up to deter the idea of war, but also it suggested that in the event of war, the war would be total.
Yeah.
Because unless people wanted to forego the alliance treaties that they had worked so hard for, there was no way that the war was going to be limited. In order for France to bow out of the war, it had to sacrifice its 2 decades of negotiations it had done with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And if Austria wanted to bow out of the war, it had to sacrifice its 4 decades of war that it had made with Germany. So it was just incomprehensible to suggest that it could have been limited. And this was why Sergei Sazonov, the Russian foreign minister, tried to insist that mobilization didn't mean war. This was why Bethmann Hollweg got so offended, because if you're mobilizing against one member of an alliance bloc, then of course the other guy is going to get offended.
Yeah.
And of course he's going to get worried.
It's going to go to total war.
Yeah, because there's no other way. No power thought that they would be in a position to not have to wage a complete war against one alliance bloc or the other. Now, there was little wild cards, such as Britain or, in the Central Powers case, Italy, because Italy wasn't thought to be very strong because of the Austrian Tyrol region that the Italians coveted for irredentist reasons. But the fact that both sides thought that an alliance bloc war would be the war that would happen was very much prevalent in the minds of their militaries.
Everybody, yeah. Nowadays, we have security councils.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, like, I don't know if Ireland has one, but definitely America and Britain have security councils. 100 years ago, those security councils were called war councils.
Yeah, yeah. And you had ministers for war as well.
Yeah, ministers for war. Now, we might have changed the name, but they do the same thing.
Mm, they do, yeah.
They orchestrate and decide where best to use military strength. Mm-hmm. So.
Absolutely, yeah. You see, there's a very big cultural difference as well. I remember in my SIPPING acronym that I kind of disagree with now, but in a way it still kind of makes sense, because the G part of the SIPPING acronym was the glorification of war. Mm. And in a way that still holds true, because looking at some of the social analysis of the pre-war era, especially in the upper nobility of, say, Britain or in France, where they upheld the cavalry kind of to a very, very high degree, even though cavalry would later prove very useless against trench warfare. It's just interesting to see how completely unlike our culture their culture was.
Yeah, well, definitely the First and Second World War shook our culture up enough to make it completely different.
Oh, definitely, yeah, yeah. It also, it kind of, like, it's the cliche, obviously, that Europe hadn't really fought a proper war since Napoleon, so it was not within the consciousness of the European powers at the time. But that kind of, I don't like those kind of things, because they kind of, like, it's almost like when people say them, they're trying to absolve people of their responsibility of launching the war. Like, yeah. People knew that war was going to be horrible. The very fact that the Tsar cancelled general mobilization on the 29th of July because he said, "I will not be responsible for a monstrous slaughter," like, that suspects he definitely foresaw what was coming.
Yeah, yeah.
But even he couldn't have known.
Because, like, they weren't unaware that they had cannons that could fire miles away. They weren't unaware that they were testing gases that could pour out people's lungs.
Mm.
They mass production and mass murder is what they were capable of.
Mm.
They were there approving these things, going, "Yes, we should get guns like that. Yes, we should get cannons like this. Yes, we should train our men to use them."
Mm.
Because if there's a war, we want to be able to kill the enemy quickly.
Yeah.
What they didn't realize is if both of you have that, you murder each other so fast that neither of you make any gains. That's You're just all dead.
It's very, very true. I'm reminded of this one of the last pages of Christopher Clark's book, The Sleepwalkers, how he was describing how the French military had just acquired this cannon, and how through tests of this cannon, the French military concluded that, oh, this cannon will wreak terrible, terrible damage on people and will result in terrible wounds like crushed bones and torn body parts and all that horrible stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And people in the French military were like, "Oh, we should outlaw the use of these guns." And this was in like 1910 or something.
Yeah.
We should outlaw the use of these guns so that no country should be in possession of them, and we should contact the Hague Convention and make sure that no country is allowed to even buy them or make them. And then the higher ups in the French military were like, "But a country has a right to defend itself, and if one country has it, then and this weapon will make sure that no one wants to fight us." And they wrote up a grand report and then congratulating the engineers on the construction of this cannon and how it was really great that they'd made such a great weapon and how it will deter everyone else from war. And then Christopher Clark made the point that, like, 50 or 60 miles across the border, the Germans were doing the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Trying to accept the fact that this weapon would kill people, but concluding that it was good for the sake of the safety of the country and that it would deter people from fighting and that a country had the right to defend itself. So they had no idea what they were getting themselves into, in some sense, because they had this idea that, well, war was going to be an adventure, God's on our side, we're going to fight this war with all these grand weapons that we've been perfecting for a long time.
Yeah.
Even though within that idea they didn't have that much of a grasp on how damaging exactly their weapons would be.
Yeah.
But they also had the catastrophic ignorance of the fact that their enemies possessed pretty much the exact same technology.
Yeah. I guess they just forgot that people die when that happens. Yeah. They forgot that, you know, people get wounded, they come back missing body parts.
Yeah, yeah, it almost is like they forget that, because there is no kind of concept at the start of any danger until the real serious casualties start piling up. There's almost the idea that it's an adventure and it's a great thing to die for one's country, as if dying isn't the end kind of thing.
Yeah, and I'd say when the generals on both sides started getting back their battle reports coming in with, "We've lost 14,000 men this morning," and they're just looking at it like, that's insane. This morning, they're like, yeah, across the line, well, call up the reserves, put them back into the trenches. Yeah. You know,
it's just incomprehensible. Like, as much as the Tsar said he would not be responsible for a monstrous slaughter, his idea of a monstrous slaughter was no way near close to what it was actually going to happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we can in some way attribute the fact that people were in ignorance of what was going to happen. You can use that fact to explain how the war was glorified and people didn't really know what was going to happen.
Yeah.
But at the same time, people did know that a general war was going to not be wonderfully great and short of any suffering at all. Especially in the German case, which is interesting. Even within the Schlieffen Plan itself, which, like, considering where we know the fact that France held on and Russia collapsed in 1917, it's especially interesting. Moltke expected the Schlieffen Plan to result in a quick defeat of France and then a relatively long drawn-out war against Russia. And he predicted that if Britain was on the side of the Franco-Russian Entente, then Britain would be blockading Germany, and Germany would be in a race to defeat Russia and then turn its attention towards Britain before the blockade strangled Germany completely.
Do you think Germany had any intentions on land grabbing in Russia or France or even Britain?
See, it's kind of hard to say. You can look at the later peace treaty between Germany and Russia in 1917 to see whether or not Germany really wanted land grabs, because what Germany and Austria demanded of Russia in order to force Russia out of the war, it seriously infringed upon Russia's sovereignty and took lots of Russian land away.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And at the start, there was ideas where
they were trying to say, we're not interested in taking land. And then when they were asked, can you guarantee that you won't take land?
Yeah.
They couldn't give guarantees.
Yeah, and then he couldn't give guarantees for France's colonies either. For them in the needless little places in Africa.
Yeah, I wish he'd said, instead of, I can't guarantee that, I don't know, I haven't asked them. You know, I haven't asked. You write down a list, I'll go ask them.
Yeah.
I'll come back in a day or so.
It would have been far smarter to do, but even the fact that he asked about, Sir Edward Grey, the British Foreign Secretary, asked about the...
I love how you said it, the way, okay, if you listen to his podcast, the German makes his presentation and everybody's quite happy.
Yeah.
And then he mentions one thing, like, we will even respect blah, de, blah, de, blah.
Yeah.
And then the British are like, no, hang on, wait a second.
Yeah.
If you'll only respect that, will you respect this?
Yeah.
No. Will you respect this? You don't know. Will you respect this? Now, hang on. You've just gone from a really nice presentation to sounding like you're about to start an entire war based on land grabs.
Yeah. Well, that what you're talking about there is the part where the German ambassador to Britain said that that Germany would respect the integrity of the Netherlands. And Sir Edward Grey was like, well, what about Belgium? And he was like,
I can't guarantee
Belgium. He's like, what about France's colonies? I don't really think we can guarantee them either.
It's like, why would you even bring that up?
Yeah, it was a completely needless thing to bring up. But it illustrated to Sir Edward Grey the story, the picture that he had painted for him by the French and Russian brushes, that Germany wanted conquest above all. And Germany certainly may have wanted conquest, and its later treaties with Russia illustrated the fact that it did want conquest, but we can't really judge the Germany in 1917 as the Germany in 1914, because the Germany in 1917 was a Germany hardened by 3 years of tough war.
I think the whole of Europe was in the same sort of boat.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Definitely was.
So I think we're moving along nicely in the actual story. We've managed to get to where Britain and Germany are negotiating.
I'm gonna ask you a question now.
Yes.
What do you think about Sir Edward Grey, the British Foreign Secretary? What do you think about his proposals in the last minute for neutrality?
Well, the one where he tried to guarantee the French neutrality.
Yeah, yeah. The ones that got Germany really excited.
The ones that were actually really fun to listen. If you listen to it, you can actually get that sense, the way you present it, you get that sense of excitement and joy. It really feels like everybody's going out and having parties and stuff.
Yeah.
It shows complete and utter ignorance by Britain, because they can't force, without declaring war on France, they can't force France to not declare war
definitely
on Germany.
Definitely not. Definitely not.
Like, basically what they were offering by saying, we'll guarantee French neutrality, is we will declare war on France if they go to war with you.
Pretty much.
Which was the offer.
Yeah.
So I don't think Sir Edward Grey realised what he was saying when he said that.
It's almost like he didn't realise that Germany was hanging on his every word.
Yeah,
at all.
Like, literally, if you side with them, we can't win.
And that's why it was kind of hilarious when he got caught out later on and he got called in front of the king and had to explain for himself.
Yeah.
And he was like, there must be some misunderstanding.
And, you know, I love the monarchies.
Yeah.
Monarchies here, I think, were the unsung heroes of peace, because they talk to each other like literally their brothers.
Mm.
All talking to each other with, you know, because it really, it, and I know you'd say, oh, but it's a family war. It's not a family war. It was war that the politicians wanted, but the monarchies wanted was definitely not war.
Yeah.
Definitely not.
Certainly, the Tsar initially didn't want it.
And I think, had we had absolute monarchy at that point, I think a war would definitely have been avoided. Especially because the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand.
Yeah, monarchical principle.
Everyone would have said, well, Serbia was wrong.
Yeah.
They shouldn't have killed an absolute monarch.
And the interesting thing there is that this ties back to the Russo-Japanese War, where it saw, in the aftermath of it, there was a load of revolutions and the Russian Parliament or Duma was set up in 1905. If that war hadn't happened, Russia may well have still been a massive autocracy. But if that was still the case and Russia never suffered its loss, Britain may not have sided with the Entente at all.
Mm.
So there's loads of what ifs that you can go along with. Yeah. But yeah, I agree with you. If Russia was still an autocracy, not bounded by its commitments to the kind of limited powers of the statesman that had recently come into the theater of Russian politics.
I'm not saying democracy is bad, but certainly having a ruler that has been trained from birth to be a ruler is a good thing.
Mm.
You know, because nowadays we elect people who they've gone in to do some training, but they only get to rep.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Present us for a limited time, and they seem to struggle, you know? We always have governments coming out with their tail between their legs because they've managed to not do well in the last 4-8 years they've been in power. And it seems like a constant cycle. And if we had someone who was just in power all the time, it would be like Sir Alex Ferguson for Manchester United football, if anybody knows the reference here.
Oh, no.
He'd be given 20 years to run at it and get the team to a point where it really was one of the best teams in football.
So Russia should just have had a 20-year czar then.
Yes. A 20 years, I think, is an appropriate amount of time for a ruler to rule, because it means that they actually get to implement plans that they have tried to implement. Mm. Like,
You could say yes. You could say that autocracy might have prevented Russia from going in. But at the same time, you have to remember, looking at it in detail, I was kind of taken aback by how conflicted the character of Tsar Nicholas II seems.
He's
because,
a pacifist that's forced to go to war is what he is.
Pretty much. But on the one hand, he surrounds himself with kind of ministers,
nationalistic, warlike
people, who espouse this kind of Balkan rhetoric, and they want to have a proud Russian Empire and everything. And on the other hand, he does not want war at all. And he doesn't seem to connect the dots between the fact that these ministers are going to want war to fulfill their ideas. An important example of this is the Dardanelles, the Straits, Constantinople, and the whole fulfillment of the Russian idea. How were the Russian statesmen going to ensure that Russia acquired this area, if not through war? Tsar Nicholas was putting himself in a strange position. His position was unlike that of certainly of the British king, but also of the German Kaiser. For that reason, the German Kaiser, I suppose you could say that he had conflictions in his character, because he'd make pretty famous outbursts, and then a few days later he'd be like, "Oh, I didn't mean that at all," kind of thing.
Oh my goodness, how Austria manipulated the young Kaiser.
I say
young, he's probably in his late 30s now.
Oh, he was in his 40s at that stage.
Really, 40s, Well, he's still a young Kaiser to me. how they managed to manipulate his sorrow into making commitments that would later
really
hurt Germany.
But you see, the interesting thing is, they knew that because of the character of the Kaiser being what it was, they knew that the best time to approach him would be while he was still upset about Franz Ferdinand's death.
That was
the best chance.
And I really love the way you described poor Franz Ferdinand. Being the rejected son because of his what was his wife?
His wife was Sophie. She was from a relatively wealthy Czech family, but she wasn't the nobility that the Habsburgs were expected to marry.
Okay,
so he was
actually trying to avoid inbreeding. That's nice.
Yeah, good old Franz Ferdinand trying to avoid inbreeding and being punished for it by his family.
Yeah, but I really love how Wilhelm really, you know, extends his...
Yeah, almost takes the couple under his wing because he foresees that in the future they'll have to work together.
Yeah, as pretty much co-rulers. Yeah, so I can understand his mourning as really... I felt so bad for him. The way you were describing their personal relationship to each other, it was really understandable.
Yeah. I really wanted to capture the reactions of the foreign countries to what had happened.
Yeah.
Because it's often suggested that war was inevitable, and this is a key question: was the First World War inevitable? I'm going to ask you: do you think the First World War was inevitable?
Well, there were certainly tons and tons of weapons manufacturers that were egging on a war.
Yeah,
you know, military complexes all set up in those countries. You know, people were looking for a way to mass produce weapons so that they could make that quick buck off it. And for that to happen, a war has to facilitate that production.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I think the way industrialization took weaponry, before it was a blacksmith and an armorer, and they would work together to make weapons, and it would be a real burden. But when you couldn't rack out just rifles day after day after day, without any slowdown, without any, all you got to do is get the minerals and resources and you're good to go. They needed to sell those because the price of those would just drop into the ground because they just had surplus. I'd say a war from their perspective was inevitable, and getting those politicians on their side. So I'd say there were many dinners and many parties thrown by weapons manufacturers.
Oh, absolutely.
To try get politicians on side for war style, war type ideas.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely. There's no doubt about that. There was certainly... the war lobbies that existed in the countries and the war parties that would have listened to them, they went hand in hand. And there's no question of the fact that once the war actually happened, it made a lot of people very, very wealthy. But what about the idea of deterrence? What about building up? What about the idea that I'm only building up loads of arms because my neighbor is doing the same?
Building up loads of arms. Yeah,
that's an idea called neorealism, where you can't trust your neighbor, and your neighbor can't trust you. So the only way to ensure your own safety is to deter him from force.
Again, that's another weapons manufacturer's idea that managed to infiltrate into politics.
Yeah.
Because, you need to protect yourself because you can't trust these guys. Here, buy all my guns. I just made them today and they're just going to sit in a warehouse unless you buy them, so...
Hey, they've been saying stuff about you. You better go get your guns.
Got lots of guns here for you.
Yeah.
I really do think it was just... it was just the idea of making money was too tempting for some people.
Yeah.
So they were the big influence on I'd say...
If let's put it this way, right? Do you think war could have been avoided in the course of the July Crisis after Gabriel Princep shot Franz Ferdinand?
Literally, when I was listening to it, I was like, "This is all razor wire stuff." Mm. Like, literally, it has to follow this exact path because if it strays just slightly, we go to peace, mm-hmm. or we go to just Austria-Hungary Serb war, and it's just. No, you're just dodging around all these little obstacles that would have prevented war just to get to war. And it was, if that was their intention, it was fabulously orchestrated.
Yeah.
It could have just ended straight away. It could have just gone straight to a halt in Belgrade.
Mm-hmm.
If Austria hadn't lingered and waited around that month and just moved straight away, it would have been passed off as a war.
Yeah.
Just as the Austro-Serb war. So, and the entire reason for it would have been Franz Ferdinand. Everyone would know about it.
Mm-hmm.
But then you're saying, well, wouldn't we then have a more devastating war later on? Because no one would learn the lessons of war.
Yeah.
Yes, maybe. Or we would realize that these guns are getting ridiculous because now I've got a submachine gun and a massive cannon.
And I've got nothing to do with it.
I've got nothing to do with it, yeah. And, you know, this cannon here I've built, I can put in Dover and it can land shells at the front lines of, you know, Belgium. I don't want to do that. That's ridiculous, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think... So, yeah, I think the arms race would have slowed down if it had gone into the 30s. I think what would have happened would be the Irish Civil War in 1914, 1915.
Yeah.
Which would have been devastating for our country. So thank God for the First World War. Because what it did was it took tons of our young fighting men, which would have fought all of our civil wars from them, and just sent them away and got them all killed. Like, they didn't come back. They didn't come back, and they didn't have any fight left in them, the ones that did come back.
Yeah.
They didn't want to have to fight a civil war. They didn't want to have their nationalism or any of those ideals. Because out there, when they saw shells destroying people, it didn't matter if you were French or if you were German or if you were British or Australian. You still die the same. You still bleed the same.
Yeah.
And so they came back with nothing left in them.
That's true. But then at the same time, we had the Irish War of Independence from 1919 to 1921.
Yeah.
And then the Irish Civil War from 22 to 23.
But again, those were very, in the scale of what civil wars are nowadays.
Yeah.
They weren't huge. And on scale of what civil wars were in America, the American Civil War. Wow.
And in terms of the... Well,
in terms of numbers, in terms of devastation... Our civil war really was localized to just a few regions. And yeah, everyone was on edge and there were raids happening here and there. But in terms of numbers, it was pretty slow and then ramped up in the last year. It wasn't as bad. So thank God for the First World War. Well, and I know that sounds bad, but it worked out really good for our country.
Well, like, regardless of how history actually panned out, there's no doubt that if the First World War had not happened, Britain would have been thoroughly occupied with the Irish question for the foreseeable future.
And I find it really patronising that they call it the question. It's like, it's not a question.
Well, it was for British politicians. The question was, do we give them home rule or not, effectively?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do we leave Ireland to its own devices, or... Is there a way, like, in other words, there was Irish questions rather than a question.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there were so many issues that had to be resolved, and it split opinion so completely. But certainly that would have kept Britain isolated with its own affairs for some time.
And so, even if the war, do you think if the war started a year later, Britain trying to maintain peace in Ireland would have...
Well, that depends.
Would have been able to join...
It depends.
If the war had started in 1915.
If by war you're talking about a war between just Germany and Russia, or a war between France and Germany?
No, the same setup. Franz Ferdinand returns the year later and gets assassinated.
Just doesn't even learn his lesson.
doesn't get the idea that people are trying to kill him and comes back the next year.
Okay, well, if it happened the exact same way as it happened in 1914, then... I mean, it depends. It depends on how ferocious the war between Britain and Ireland, let's say, was at this stage, and whether or not the fact that Germany had violated Belgian neutrality would be sufficient to make Ireland decide, okay, we need to stop fighting Britain and fight Germany instead. But in reality, I think that Britain and Ireland would have been simply too caught up in their own affairs to involve themselves.
Yeah.
And as well as that, we can't predict how the war between the two factions within Ireland would have gone, how long it would have lasted, etc.
Especially if that civil war, the way it was the Irish versus the Irish.
Yeah.
Okay? Which side do Britain take?
Yeah, well, that's
the
thing.
And because they can't take a side, would that then result in the civil war spreading to Britain itself?
Yeah. Well, some historians had suggested that it was going to be a British civil war because it split political opinion so much. And don't forget, there was a lot of Irish people
and so
spread across Britain.
If the British had decided, right, we'll side with the Unionists, the second they moved troops to support the Unionists, they would have had their own civil war on their hands with people trying to resist, with armies trying to resist being deployed on the Unionist side.
Yeah, it would have been just a generally awful situation. But I want to move on from Britain because I want to move on to another question. Alternative history question for you. Let's look at Russia in this case.
The badass.
Yeah. Say Gavrilo.
Russia, you lost something in communism. You really did.
Oh, it didn't just lose. It lost a whole lot of stuff in communism. But say Gavrilo Princip did not kill Franz Ferdinand.
Okay.
Say Franz Ferdinand, all that happened was that first assassination attempt. And then he ended up turning. He didn't turn.
He went straight.
He went straight along, and he avoided Gavrilo Princip altogether.
You know what I think? If they hadn't decided, oh, we took a wrong turn, and then stopped.
Yeah, it would have been fine.
Yeah, if they had taken that turn and just driven on down the end of that road.
Yeah,
they probably would have avoided getting shot.
Yeah, it was really the amazing fact was that they stopped dead in
front
of him.
Right in front of him. And he's like, well, I feel obliged to shoot
him now. I almost can't not shoot him because he's right in front of me. But the interesting thing was that Princip was following the itinerary that was relevant earlier on. Like, technically, it was now outdated by the fact that
they were aware he was trying to be
assassinated. And so the itinerary had been changed.
Mm-hmm.
But because that one cop car at the front...
He's so lovely, Franz Ferdinand. He's like, let's go to the hospital.
Yeah.
And talk to the people that were...
Yeah.
Affected.
But so say he had survived, he had gone home, he'd been like, I was nearly killed in Sarajevo. And I'm like, oh, good grief, what a terrible thing to happen. Regardless of what would have happened to Austria-Hungary then, how it would have reformed or reacted, or how the Hungarian question would have been solved, what do you think would have happened with Russia? What do you think Germany and Russia would have done to each other in the years to come? Do you think there would have been the whole preventative war from the German perspective that has long been espoused by historians who claim that Germany wanted the war in 1914 because if it didn't have it, then Russia would be soon uncontainable?
No. I think the monarchies would have held in check. I think the monarchies would have maintained the pieces as long as possible.
Yeah.
But what I do think is that the rising that happens, the communist rising, would have actually warranted international response. That it would have been put down by the other monarchies to maintain the Russian monarchy.
I agree with you, because certainly if that kind of a rising... Like, first of all, it wouldn't have happened with the ferocity that it did. We're talking about the Russian Revolution, by the way, that overthrew the Russian monarchy and established communism. If it hadn't happened during war, it probably wouldn't have been as successful because it wouldn't have had as much human suffering to draw upon, so that it wouldn't have been as...
And it would have had more sympathies among the European powers to try and put that down on behalf of Russia.
Yeah, because Russia had done the same, don't forget, during the 1848 revolutions, Russia had effectively been the policeman of Europe and ensured that in Germany and in Austria, that no kind of governments or institutions were set up that were kind of anathema to the idea of the monarchical principle or the old order.
Yeah.
But yeah, what I'm trying to get at is the idea of the preventative war, and I'm trying to almost demonstrate the fact that it's very hard to look at Russia by itself or Germany by itself and state this is where this country would have been if war had not happened. Mm. Because in order to look at Russia and kind of examine where it will be in the future if war hadn't happened, you need to look at Britain and you need to look at Germany. Britain, because in 1914, Britain and Russia were very much on different paths, despite the fact that the Entente and their naval conventions had kind of established them on the same sort of ground. But the reason why this had happened was not so much because Britain hated Germany, which has been the common misconception that Britain pursued the Franco-Russian Entente and tried to get into it and make it a triple Entente because it was afraid of what Germany was doing. The reason why Britain joined the Entente in the first place was because Britain and its policymakers saw the Entente as the chance to address and pacify its two biggest rivals, in this case France, who Britain was a rival with in Africa and in Asia, and Russia, who Britain was perhaps the biggest rival with in and had been for the past century, really, ever since the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and who Britain had been combating itself against since, like, most visibly in the Crimean War, but also through policy and through its trying to contain Russia and its plans of expansion.
Mm.
So what I'm trying to get at here is the idea that if a war had not happened in 1914, I don't see a war happening for the foreseeable future. And I also see the fracturing of the alliance system that was set in place. And I'll explain why. The first point, you look at Germany and France, and you might think, well, these two countries, they're never ever going to get along. In a way, you might be right, but the way I see it happening is these two countries, they could only arm themselves to a certain point before it became impossible to maintain or continue with. The Germans and the French both, of course, had their grievances with each other, but you can only arm yourself to a certain point before you can't afford it anymore. And when you get to that stage, you can either decide, okay, we're going to use all this stuff that we have, or you can decide to go along in a policy of détente. And now, it might have been hard for German or French policymakers to imagine this strategy, but perhaps with a bit of give and take influenced by Britain, maybe that would have come about. And if that had come about, then you could have seen a key reason for the alliance system that had come into being. You could see that actually coming apart. A lot, an important thing to remember is just how much the alliance system itself relied upon the Franco-German antagonism. So if that was pacified, it would have made a lot of other things easier to come about. So let's look at, for example, the British and the Russian rivalries, which had supposedly been pacified by the existence of the Entente. But if you look at the fact that even in 1914, British policymakers were concerned that Russia was not respecting the terms of their treaties in, say, Persia, for example, and they were acting like they owned the place, basically, these were still real concerns. And up until the point that the war itself broke out, there was a growing lobby within Britain that suggested we should stop pacifying Russia, we'd stop appeasing Russia, and we should start combating Russia. And the best way to do this is to look to Germany for help.
Yeah.
And that didn't necessarily mean that they were going to become Germany's best friend, but it did mean that in 1914, because Britain had won the naval race, which is a key point that I didn't know, and I thought, like, I completely missed, totally in my last special, it removes, with the ending of the naval race effectively in Britain's favour, it removes the key point of antagonism between Britain and Germany.
Yeah.
And when that's gone, Britain has more of a free hand, and it has a reason to kind of bring Germany into its sphere. And of course, as well, this whole policy is being facilitated by the fact that the German Chancellor is very much pro-Britain. And of course, the German Kaiser, you could never, like, criticise him and say that he's...
He loves Britain.
Oh, God, yeah.
He all of his aspirations are because he loves Britain.
Yeah, pretty much. He was effectively in awe of Britain, and he wanted British attention and British affection and all that other stuff. He wanted to be appreciated by Britain. The best way to get that was to be embark on a good relationship with Britain, and that could have happened.
Except he was an idiot, so he thought the way to impress Britain was by impressing it, literally by, like, check out my guns.
Yeah.
And then Britain was like, holy crap, you've got guns.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
Yeah, that's very, very true. Very, very accurate, yeah. Yeah, but like we can see this catastrophic misunderstanding of the British psychology throughout history and with Hitler as well. In many ways, 1914 was like a year of détente, and had the war not broken out, there is a very strong chance that...
that détente would have continued.
It would have continued, because Britain was facing its own significant problems. It had significant problems with its Russian relationship. France and Germany were spending so much money on arms. France, for example, was...
3 years of just mobilising.
Yeah, pretty
not
much.
Not mobilising.
Its 3-year military bill required that it recruit 90% of its manpower, which is crazy, and it's not sustainable. It was not sustainable to recruit such a high amount of manpower, and German planners would have recognised that in a few years...
they're just going to go back to being a small French army.
Yeah, like, if France starts to appreciate the fact that its own military spending is not sustainable, and Germany at the same time starts to appreciate the fact that, okay, in a few years Russia is going to be too powerful to contain anyway... and a war does not come, because preventative war, though it was favoured by some in German military circles, was definitely not favoured by the Chancellor or Kaiser. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if you add to that as well the fact that in the French political atmosphere, the French President Raymond Poincaré had taken Russian bribes and Russian money during his presidential race, and if you add to that, I know we keep adding stuff to this, but if you add to that the fact that the French pacifist Jean Huaret, who was killed, if you remember, on the eve of war, if he managed to survive and ended up forming a kind of government, Joseph Callot, who was part of that whole Callot affair that kept France so occupied. I know there's a lot of ingredients, but bear with me. If you add all that together, what it looks like is a kind of more peaceful France learning from its previous ideas of rearmament and embarking on towards a more détente policy with Germany. And this Germany now, inspired by the fact that it needs to have Britain on side, and inspired by the fact that the British relationship is bearing some fruit, might decide that the best course for itself, knowing that it can't win a war between France and Russia anymore, if this is in a few years' time, decides to embark on a policy of peace with France itself. And if that happens, then the very alliance system itself comes crumbling down.
So that is how the alliance system was on the edge of ending at 1914, just by its own, you know, pointlessness.
Yeah, by the very way that it was set up. Yeah. But because war happened, it dragged everyone who was, like, in particular Britain, loosely bound to it. It dragged them into the war that they didn't want.
Yeah.
And now, another point to look at is Russia itself and how the Russian kind of desire to take the Straits of the Dardanelles might have inspired a European war. And in some ways that's true, but if you look at the Russian episode, the Russian profile episode I did, and how the Russians were very concerned that the British were building dreadnoughts for the Ottomans, and how that would have resulted in the Russians no longer having naval superiority in the Black Sea, I found that very interesting, because first of all I was like, well, why are the British building a dreadnought for the Russian enemy? And as well as that, I thought, well, wow, if the Russian position is that disadvantaged, then surely they're going to act before that dreadnought comes. Now, in the history that we know, these two dreadnoughts are stopped from going to the Ottomans, not because the British don't want the Ottomans to have them, because that'll disadvantage the Russians, but because the British want every dreadnought possible. So Churchill orders that these dreadnoughts be snapped up and kept in the British fleet instead of being sent to the Ottomans.
Yeah.
But if this hadn't happened, and if Russian planners had seen those Ottoman dreadnoughts appear and realised what the situation was now, they might have decided to act and declare war on the Ottomans before this could have happened. And if they had declared that war...
they probably wouldn't have declared it. They would have mobilised until the Ottomans declared war on
them. Oh, yeah, of
course.
That's
probably what would have happened.
Yeah.
Or the Ottomans would have been cheeky and just sat there going, I'm not declaring war. And they both just sit there looking at each other. Will you declare war first so that everybody on my defensive pack comes in? And then you know.
And then one of them listens to Bethman about how it's legally right to declare war.
Yeah, well, you should actually be declaring it. So, fine, I'll declare it. I declare war. None of your defensive treaties are in play. So all of my defensive treaties come in, and now it's 5-1. How does that feel?
Yeah, how you like that, Ottomans? Yeah. But an important thing to realise about that was that the Russian planners had realised that Britain was not going to support Russia in the event of a war with the Ottomans. The whole Ottoman Straits question, if you remember the Bosnian crisis from 1908-09, where Bosnia-Herzegovina was annexed by Austria-Hungary in exchange for Austria's support for improved Russian terms in the Dardanelles. Now, this was an Austro-Russian agreement, and the fact that it deteriorated and resulted in Russia being effectively bullied by the Central Powers is a strange result in itself. But what I took from this was the fact that the French and the British protested at Russia trying to get better terms than the Dardanelles. The Dardanelles, even at this late stage, was still a big issue to the French and British, who recognised that if Russia did get increased terms and got better stance in that area, they would impress themselves upon first that area, then they would move to the Dardanelles and take Constantinople, and then they would move to the Mediterranean. Yeah. Now, this is a gigantically exaggerated picture of what Russia was actually capable of,
yeah,
as will be demonstrated by its performance in the war. But the very fact that Russia was believed by France and Britain to be capable of this is the only thing that mattered.
Yeah.
Because it meant, yeah, that even in 1914, Russia's supposed allies feared what it was capable of.
Man, and I'd say, you know what it is, the Russians could talk the talk back in the day, and they could still do it now.
Mm.
But when it actually comes to putting guns in people's hands and putting them out to fight, it's completely different.
Yeah, well, especially the case of putting guns in people's hands, they weren't even capable of doing that, because the vast majority of Russian soldiers that were sent to the front didn't have boots or weapons or even proper military clothing. So Russia recognized that it was going to have to, if it did want a war with the Ottomans, which is the major war that people foresee coming in the foreseeable future, if a general European war didn't happen.
If that was the case,
and if that this war
is
between
this is the alternative history.
Oh yeah,
you want to talk
the
about,
definite
yeah.
the definite alternative history, like for the First World War. But if this is the war that did come about in the years after the failed assassination attempt on Franz Ferdinand, let's say.
It's interesting, right? It's interesting to see that Churchill pulled back those dreadnoughts and then years later would plan Gallipoli as well.
Yeah.
That's, you know, he must have had it in for the Ottomans.
Well, it was. Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. It comes down to them seeing the Ottomans as the soft underbelly of the Central Powers. But I mean, the very tactical idea of invading the Central Powers through the Ottomans is pretty...
It's pretty stupid.
Pretty stupid, yeah. And they ended up causing the downfall of the Ottomans through the invasion of the Middle East anyway, and inspiring Arab nationalism that the Allies had absolutely no intention of fulfilling once the war was over. But that's another story. Anyway, yeah. What I'm trying to really get to here is the idea that the Russian planners knew from experience that they weren't going to be able to inspire Britain or France to support them in a war that was launched for the sole purpose of taking Constantinople. So, in order to get Constantinople, another war, a general kind of European war that resulted in from some other cause, would
was
have
the
to,
only way for them to get the straits without going out
so,
of their way for the straits.
Yes, so in a kind of a weird logic, Russian planners thought that, well, if we make, say a European war happens for whatever reason, and we take Constantinople by way of like a sideshow, a military sideshow of that war, say, then that's the only way we can see it happening.
Now, I'm sure France and Britain would object, but as their ally, they
as their ally, and because it would be in the midst of another war, the called fog of war idea would be prevalent, and there wouldn't be much that Britain or France could do, unless of course the roles were completely reversed and we didn't know who Russia was at war with in the first place. But you kind of see my point.
I absolutely see your point.
The only real war that people could see coming
wasn't just a reaction to an event. It was actually just in existence as a threat.
Yeah, well, like, they've been at war with each other many, many times. Mm-hmm. And the whole question of the Dardanelles still existed and was wrapped up in the whole Balkan nationalism idea.
Yeah.
So it could have been very possible that Serbia decided to launch a second war, let's just say, and against the Ottomans, and the whole Balkan League was resurrected and Russia decided to join in. Even in the event of that, Russia may not have taken the bait for the simple fact that they didn't think Britain and France would support them.
Yeah.
So, what I take from this is that nothing was inevitable. This was what really annoyed me. I remember seeing someone linked me to a BBC thing about the outbreak of the First World War and how the Archduke, he just managed to be killed and he wasn't supposed to be there and all that stuff. And, if only that hadn't happened, then war wouldn't have happened. And then like 5 minutes later, the narrator was like, but even if the Archduke hadn't been killed, war was still inevitable. As soon as someone says war is inevitable, you know that they're talking out of their behind. Because to state that war was still inevitable just suggests that, like, you already heard, dear listener, the amount of, like, variables I just threw at you there. But, like, come on, there's so many possibilities that don't involve war. And even the very fact that war happened in the first place, I think, in 1914, after the July Crisis, is a testament not to the fact that war was inevitable, but the very way that it happened just shows how close it was to not happening at all.
Yeah, so that really brings us to the end of alternate history and brings us to the end of the actual history podcast. I have to say again, you were fantastic. You were a workhorse and you really... You went out of your way to give us some of the most insightful podcasting I've ever had to listen to. Not that I've had to listen to it, I had the pleasure of listening.
I did tie him down and hold a gun to his head.
It was my soundtrack that I was listening to while I was playing a video game called Verdun, which is a first-person shooter set in the trenches of the First World War. When I was listening to that... I'd be, you know, running across the no man's land, getting hit by mortars, getting hit, shot away, and at the same time listening to the intricacies of the negotiations and the failed diplomacy, which is perfect for your podcast, that led to it.
And you and all the other soldiers would be like, is this the reason I'm here?
Yeah, oh my goodness. I was like, guys, you know the reason we're here, yeah? Some guy died, and then we didn't talk to each other for ages, and then we all decided to go to war.
Yeah.
So... I guess we really have to thank you for listening to us ramble on for the last hour or so. I don't know how this is going to edit down, but it's been a pleasure talking with you, Zach.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure as always, Sean.
Yeah, so remember to be fit. Now, I am going to run a competition. It's not a competition, but it's literally, I'm just going to pick names out of a hat. But it's not names out of a hat. We're going to pick names off of Facebook.
But it's not names out of Facebook.
It is, though. So, right, if you leave a comment on the link to this episode on Facebook, what day is it now? Okay, on the 31st of August, so the last day of August, we're going to pick a winner. And that winner will get 2 copies of Verdun on Steam, which is currently retailing at $19.99. So unless you want to wait for a Steam sale, all you have to do to get in with a chance of winning this is just leave a comment saying, oh, Verdun, something related to Verdun.
So that we know you want it.
So you know we want it, so we can differentiate from people who are just commenting on the podcast.
And itself. Now, why would people want to play Verdun?
Well, Verdun is a very... realistic, like I say realistic, it's still a video game, but they represent the charges and the back and forths of trench warfare very well. For the likes of games like Call of Duty or Battlefield, where you can really get away with just running around and doing your own thing. This, you stay in your trench and you go forward when you're told to go forward and you come back when you're told to come back. You know, you're running through trenches with bayonets. It's close quarters combat with weapons that really aren't designed for close quarters combat. You're trying to pick off people while they run across no man's land. You're trying to run across no man's land yourself. You spend the majority of the game dying. I feel like I've probably died 100 times in that game and maybe only killed 6 people. Now, that's probably because I'm bad at games, but, you know, I'm taking the game literally and, you know, getting to a trench, waiting for the whistle to blow, and then running out with 5 or 6 guys across no man's land, hoping that one of us gets across to the either German or French, depending on which battle you're in, get to their jump-off lines or get to their fallback lines and capture those trenches. It's you know, and the games last about an hour. So it's not like these condensed, you know, first-person shooters, which are very quick and run inside of 20 minutes.
Yeah. It's not like Take No Prisoners combat.
Yeah, and it's not that they're trying to... The objectives are, like, take a flag or kill enough people. It's literally run across there and take that trench. And then, if you have the momentum, you just keep going. So, it was released earlier, I think, just the end of July. It came out for the centenary. It's open beta early access on Steam, so I don't know, you can avoid it as long as you want, but if you have the game key, which we are offering by leaving a comment about Verdun on the Facebook.
Once we decide that you win, or once Sean decides that you win, we'll get in contact with you.
Yeah, we will get in contact with you on the 31st. You have to have a Steam account, and it's a multiplayer only game, so you will also need a pretty good internet connection. So. Yeah. Those are the requirements. I mean, it's graphically beautiful. If you have a fantastic computer, absolutely go for it. And if not, I will be on there playing, and I would absolutely be happy to play Verdun with any of you listeners that are also video gamers. if you guys want to hop on there, we can storm the trenches as the Germans or the French together.
Yeah. Very good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's I don't know. I think that's, I feel like that's the first time we've run a competition, but
it really kind of is, yeah.
But you know, with the centenary, I think it's appropriate.
I think it is appropriate.
And plus, we both love our video games, mm-hmm. so it's something that I feel like it's appropriate for this podcast.
No,
now
definitely.
I think we should move on to thank yous.
Yes. Will you be able to get my phone? It's
just like in
the shelf there. Okay. So now is the time when I thank people for all their donations. By name, not by amount, because I think that would be kind of infringing upon their privacy.
So, if you all start sending like 1 cent, you're not making your name, okay?
Yeah, those 10 cent donations, they don't exist, don't worry. So we'll start, first of all, Joanne Marin, thank you very much for your donation on the 25th of June. Nicholas Stanley, thank you very much for your donation on the 27th of June. Michael Day, thank you very much for your donation on the 7th of July. Chris Sandys, thank you very much for your donation on the 23rd of July. Michael Cabral, thank you very much for your donation on the 24th of July. Michael P. McCormick, thank you very much for your donation on the 26th of July. Seamus Parl, thank you very much for your donation on the 26th of July again. Wow, that was a good day for me. Rohit Devan, I think that's how you pronounce your name. Thank you very much for your donation on the 31st of July. Alan Walker, thank you very much for your donation on the 8th of August. Karen Roth, thank you very much for your donation on the 8th of August. Finally, Jason Flaher, thank you very much for your donation on the 14th of August. You are all wonderful people, and all those donations made such a difference to me, and they meant that I got to buy some new clothes. Actually, not really. I haven't bought new clothes for ages. What they really meant...
It was a great morale boost.
It was a great morale boost, and it will all go towards my master's, which will make me a better person and podcaster. Okay, so following all those thank yous, I just have one last thank you to make to you in general, the listener, the whole generic thank you. Thank you very much
for listening. Thank you for sticking with us for the past, what are we, 2, 3 years?
Yeah.
4 years?
No. Just making massive jump.
10 years.
Thanks for that 3 decade of support. Yeah, okay, we've been together for 2 years plus. Since May, so thanks very much for
supporting
us. Thank
you if you're a new listener, and thank you for being with us for the whole time.
But I'd really like to thank you as well for your support for the July Crisis and for the 30 Years War as well, because I went straight into it from one to the other. So thanks so much, guys. I really am a slave to my whims and a slave to this podcast at times, but knowing that you guys are there on the other end makes such a difference. So thank you so much. And keep on telling your friends, keep on spreading the word, because it's making a huge difference. And
keep telling inanimate objects as well.
Keep telling inanimate objects.
Tell your pets, tell your grandparents.
Yeah. Explain what a podcast is to your grandparents, because that's always fun.
Well, you know what's going to happen? Grandparents are going to start knowing what podcasts are. Like, the old people are getting younger.
Oh, that's true, yeah. I suppose. But imagine our generation when we're grandparents. Anyway, that's really scary.
It's so good. So much.
It's been an incredibly stressful past month and a bit, but it's also been absolutely amazing in
Let's end it the same way you end every other podcast.
Yes.
Instead of saying thanks, let's do the "and that's why we ended the podcast." Dun dun. Dun, dun. You know, your little music.
No, it was more like dun, dun, dun.
Those, like, the way you ended each podcast was just so good.
I did that on purpose. I was like, okay.
It was just like, oh, I want to hear the next one. I want to hear the next one. This is what led Britain to take off its the sunglasses thing from it, CSI.
Oh, God.
Oh, that's what it was. That's what that little calling at the end. Yeah,
I even cut it so that it would be perfectly in place.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Every time. It was so good.
Thank you. Yeah, I even like got my voice trained to a degree so that it would come across perfectly in that form.
Yeah. Oh, man. It worked really. Yeah, you were in tune with the music.
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah, it was really
good. It is my goal.
Yeah.
So thanks very much for joining us. And we'll see you all again.
Very soon.
Very soon.
Very soon.
Very soon. So, my name is Zach.
And my name is Sean.
And we'll see you all again.
In When Diplomacy Fails.
Thanks!
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.